Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church Podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Here we go. One more time. Today we're going to be in Revelation 12:13, and we'll go through Revelation 13:10, as it likes to say there on the description for today. We've had a lot going on here. Satan has just been, the dragon, let's refer to it as the dragon, has just realized that it had been thrown down to the earth and is about to wreak havoc upon it. The dragon had just fought the archangel Michael. It is our understanding that's who that is. And now Michael had won, and now the dragon now comes down to earth and cause all kinds of tomfoolery, chaos, horrible, horrible things. Chases the woman who we believe to be the true Jerusalem around, the woman is eventually saved and sent off to the desert. We'll talk a little bit more about what that looks like here in a second, but we'll just look there. So we're going to do verse 13 of chapter 12 through chapter 10. It's not a whole lot of verses, not for this class or this discussion that we typically have significantly more, but for this week we're only going to go through chapter 13, verse 10. As we start, we're going to be looking at Satan's war on the earth and how she has been hurled down to the earth to cause all kinds of problems. And so let's read that. We'll just read to the end of chapter 12 and see how we're now returning to what we saw originally or previously in verse 6. So away we go. And when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman, so that she could fly to the wilderness, to her place where she was nourished for a time and times and a half a time from the presence of the serpent. And the serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman, so that this might caused her to be swept away with the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and drank up the river which the dragon poured out of its mouth. So the dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her children who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. Interesting how it doesn't say the lamb, but hey, I didn't write this, John did. So, or most likely he did, maybe some of his friends, editors and the like. And so anyways, where we are with this at this point is, a lot of the symbolism that we're seeing here is, of course, it's apocalyptic symbolism, and it's related or tied to a lot of what we see from the book of Daniel, especially Daniel chapter 7. And we'll be making references to that today as we have in the past. We're also going to be looking at the additional symbolism tied to just Old Testament Jewish thought, as well as how some of this tied into kind of the just pagan religious beliefs as well. And what we're seeing is that John is pulling different stories, different ideas, different concepts together, meshing them together to be able to tell a story about the ferociousness of this dragon and who all the characters are who are involved here and why that is significant. So like I said, we head now return back to verse 6 of this chapter, where the woman heads off to the desert. The dragon has been defeated by Michael and is sent to terrorize those on the earth and to cause, like I said, all kinds of havoc to them. We can recall, as we talked last time, the idea of the woman or the woman here. Some say she symbolizes Mary. Some says she symbolizes the church. Some say she symbolizes the true Israel, or what Israel was supposed to be. And I'm going to go with that at this point. And the reason that is that if the woman gave birth to the Messiah in verse 5, now that would make sense that, you know, from the lineage through Israel, the Messiah came. Now, I could also see where you could say it could be Mary, but there's not a lot of, in my opinion, evidence of it being Mary, even though there's some really neat artistic work depicting this person as Mary. There's also some depicting other things. So anyways, now the true Israel, as we'll say, or the woman, shares along with the Messiah the wrath of the dragon. And that seems to be a wrath that is going to be very, very unpleasant. Recall from the Gospels that those who follow are connected to Christ or the Messiah are persecuted much like he is. And Jesus even says that would be true. There seems to be no separation between those who are faithful to Christ and Christ when it comes to Satan's wrath or or evil, or what evil tries to do to people. Satan is, you know, the word from regarding Satan means his adversary, and we get that from Job, and we get that from other parts of the Bible as well. And pretty much it is the opposite of what God is. So if God is good, then Satan is evil, and we many times have to personify good and evil in order for us to make sense of it, which is why we a lot of times make Satan to seem much more than what personally it or he is, when actually it's just not just, but it is many times depictions of evil, evil in systems, evil in society, evil in the structure of society, evil within humans ourselves, and many times we like to lay blame it was Satan's fault, when in fact it is actually just the fault of sinful humans, and how that's kind of compiled over years and years, centuries. And so anyways, this evil continues to build up, and it gets worse, and it becomes personified. And I'm not saying there's not beings that are evil. There absolutely are, right, based on my understanding of demons and stuff like that. But I think sometimes we put a little too much emphasis on the person of Satan, when actually there's just a lot more evil just going around this earth that is separate from that. Otherwise, if we put Satan at this level of power, we're now dealing with two gods, right? We do have an all-powerful God, the God of Israel, the God that we believe in, but then you kind of make Satan a god too if he's actually literally fighting God at that level. And so that's just one way to look at it. Take that with that as you want and what you will. What we can know from what we're seeing here, this is the Exodus story. The Exodus story is actually woven throughout this part of the book. Much like Pharaoh pursued the people of Israel as they left Egypt, the dragon pursues the woman, the true Israel. So you can look at it here. The Pharaoh, again, being a personification of evil. Could have been, of course, a historical person, absolutely. But also showing what the symbolism evil is as well. The reference to the woman's wings like an eagle points to, say, Exodus 14:8, where God tells the people of Israel that he carried the people on eagle's wings to protect them. You also see this from Exodus 1:11, which would also help us understand the river that the dragon spews out to capture the woman, much like the Pharaoh did when he wanted to drown all the male children of Israel. If you remember that story of Moses, the use of water to kill the people of Israel. Number 16, 31 through 33 reminds us of the story of the men of Korah who were swallowed up by the earth and went down into Sheol. It's a whole other lesson in itself. We can see here that the major theme of this section or group of verses is about the hatred of Satan has towards the church based on his hatred for the Messiah, or evil's hatred, or evil against good. We know this to be true based on what Jesus told his disciples in John 15:21. They will treat you this way because of my name. Those who are evil, those who are not righteous, will treat you this way because of my name. Not just this one little being, Satan, running around doing it, but evil people. people who are not followers of God. Those who are not faithful. Systems, governments. And that's what John is dealing with here, is government of Rome is the evil personified. And And if Rome is evil, and that's what Rome is, and that's what John is referring to, that's what we're doing here. The Romans are persecuting the Christian church, just like Jesus was persecuted by the Romans just years before, probably about 60 or so years before. As we move forward here, we have verse 14. The woman is given the great eagle's wings, not the same as what we see in chapter 8, verse 13. They are to symbolize divine deliverance and enablement. We know from the Song of Moses that this would be something people would understand based on what God had done for Jacob and when God took care of Jacob back in Deuteronomy 32. Isaiah 40, verse 31 is a very popular reference to eagle's wings, where the people will soar on wings like eagles, will renew their strength. The wings of the eagle allow the woman to fly to the desert for spiritual renewal. The isolation in the desert is needed for spiritual renewal. And it allows for complete detachment from the world. And you may remember last time we referred to the great city. Some people say that's Jerusalem. Some people say it's Rome. It is, I would say, it's the world structures itself, world governments, to get away from that. And what was ultimately happening here is, of course, the preparation for the coming of the new heaven and the new earth. The woman is there for 3.5 years. Again, we see this numbers, that number of a time and times and a half a time. That is just has been consistent. It's a significant amount of time. 3.5 years would make sense. It actually points to again Daniel 7 here, where you have Antiochus Epiphanes who oppressed the people for about that time period amount of time. I'd encourage you to go back and read Daniel 7 and the verses, the chapters before and after. Beyond renewal, the word usage here could also be pointing to training or the rearing up of children. So more than just being renewed, the woman is being trained up in the way she should go. She is now fully protected spiritually from the wrath of Satan. So Israel, the true Israel, the church, I don't know if you can go that far yet, but is being protected spiritually. Remember, a lot of what we talk about throughout this is that there's a promise of spiritual protection to help you remain faithful, to help the people remain faithful, but there isn't a promise of physical protection, which is why we have the martyrs that we've seen multiple times throughout this book. Verses 15 and 16, the woman flies to her place of refuge. A great of a water, amount of water is spewed out from the mouth of the dragon to overtake her. The earth, of course, rescues her by opening up and swallowing her. We know that in the Old Testament, a flood is used many times as a metaphor for overwhelming evil and tribulation. All you have to do is look at the story of Noah. You can also look at the story of the people of Israel crossing the Sea of Reeds and seeing that the Pharaoh's army is destroyed, of course. The evil army is destroyed. So that is something that the people reading along here, following along, will be very familiar with. Like in Psalm 18:4, there's the floods of ungodliness, also in Isaiah 43:2, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. Neither of those connect with what is going on here exactly, as it is evil that is spewing out the flood, but there are some thoughts on this as to what is being referred to. And so what it could be, it could be related to a historical event in the war between Rome and Jerusalem, which was AD 66 to AD 73, where they threatened to cut off the escape of the church from Jerusalem during that time. Another is a literal flood, like the one that prevented the Jews of Gadara from escaping across the Jordan from the Romans in March of AD 68. This was reported by Josephus that the Jordan River was swollen, keeping them from being able to escape. We know that John has used multiple references in the past and kind of, like I've said just moments ago, that he mashes these ideas together to fit the need of what he is trying to communicate. There's one more option. If you go back to Acts chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, where the Jewish authorities tried to destroy the early church. And then one more time, it could be a reference to what Paul teaches regarding a river of lives that will threaten even those who are faithful from 2 Thessalonians 2, 9 through 11. We will see in chapter 22, verse 1 of this, that this river of deceit has a counterpart in what we refer to as the river of life that flows from the heavenly throne. there's a lot of questions here about the earth opening it up, and why is nature stepping in here to help the woman? We know that from Romans chapter 8, 19 through 22, nature is involved in the consequences of human sin. With that, it would be a stretch to say that this current verse is teaching that. John probably wasn't that probably wasn't John's intention, but there is that some of that pointing in that direction. Most likely, what it could be looking at a reference to how some rivers in part of Asia flowed underground, much like the Lycus River near Colossa would. Again, another good reason to know the context before making any conclusions. We don't think John is trying to say here that nature is on God's side in the moral struggle between good and evil or right and wrong. I don't think that's what he's trying to say either, but it could be, but I don't think that's where he's going with it. Verse 7, 17, the dragon realizes that the efforts are futile, so he heads off to harass the rest of her offspring. There are a couple of ways to interpret the church here. One could be Satan's attempt to destroy the Palestinian church. It could be the modern day people who are Christians in Palestine, but most likely it's referring to, the Palestinian church, which Jesus was a Palestine. So it was the people in that region, and even going into Asia Minor, but also going to Jerusalem and the surrounding area, Galilee and all that. So that could be that destruction going on. It could be pointed to the rest of the offspring being Gentile believers throughout the empire, which is very possible at this point based on how many years in we are into the first century church. The other to be, and most probably, is believers in general, as distinguished by the male child in verse 5 and in verse 13. They are brothers and sisters in Christ, and that's who is being chased around here. These are the faithful ones who are obedient to Christ. And so you see that as we go through here. So he's off to go. He's enraged. He's off to go after the children, and especially those who are righteous and holds the testimony of Jesus. And of course, we know through that a lot of bad things would happen. Look at us as we continue to move through this so quickly, because now we're going into chapter 13. We have wrapped up Satan chasing the woman. The true Israel. And now we will continue on. Depending on your translation, at the end of chapter 12, the dragon was standing on the edge of the sea, or you may see it as in the first chapter of 13. Again, your translation may have chapter 13, verse 1, being actually the chapter 12, verse 17, or vice versa. It could be verse 1. Doesn't matter. I bring things like that up. Why do I bring things like that up? I bring things like that up to let you identify and know that there are different translations out there, different editors who have, and interpreters who interpret the scripture a little bit differently. This is not a huge difference, especially since originally there were no such thing as chapters or verses, but it does allow us to know that different words are interpreted differently. And depending on where you do start a new paragraph or a new sentence or a new section, will sometimes change the meaning of the scripture and of what it's trying to communicate. I don't think that's really happening here, but it's something that has been noticed. So we note it here. It seems Satan on his own could not take out the woman and her offspring, so we're now going to be introduced to two beasts. Today we'll only be talking about from the beast from the sea, and next time we'll talk about the beast from the earth. and this will allow all three can make war on the woman's offspring, or the church. As with apocalyptic literature, they are considered beasts and are quite gruesome to keep the theme going, and that's how apocalyptic literature works. That's how mythological literature works, is where you have these horrible, hard to describe, very hard to even write or draw out types of beast. We'll first meet a seven-headed sea monster, one head that has been mutilated by a sword. As we'll see, the beast will be able to wreak havoc on the saints for 42 months. He is also allowed to blaspheme God, and there will be more detail to come. The second beast that we will learn will come from the earth. He is less terrifying, but able to deceive people with fun and fancy miracles. This is the beast that forces people to get the mark of the beast. And if they do not have it, they will not be able to be in the world of commerce. They will not be able to buy or sell things, but we'll have more on that as well. So you have to come back next week for that one. But this week we'll talk about the beast from the sea. But ultimately what we have here is what we refer to as an unholy trinity of evil with the dragon and the two beasts. The two beasts seem to represent the power of Rome and the willingness of local religious authorities to cooperate in carrying out the plans of Satan. That's not good for anyone. All right, before we get too far along here, let's see where we are. So we will read, I'm just going to help and read the entire Beast of the Sea or Beast from the Sea verses. That's 10 verses, and then we will jump into it. And again, as we read through this, keep in the back of your mind the other apocalyptic piece of literature that is relatively popular, and that's the Book of Daniel. And see how there's some similarities, especially the descriptions of the beasts. And you can see that John was influenced by some of that as we go through this. And the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. Then I saw a beast coming out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads on his horns. And on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and the mouth like the mouth of a lion. Remember the likes? We're back to likes, just like we've talked about in other verses before in the past. There are likes. He's trying to do as best as he can to do this. And the dragon, because remember, this is about the experience, not about the specifics, the analyzing it. Ooh. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. So the dragon on the beast on his own accord did not have the power to do what he was about to do. I saw in his heads, as it had been slain, and a fatal wound was healed, and the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. They worshipped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who is able to wage war with him? There is given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him." Again, we see 42 months, or also known as time, and time, and half a time, and time, and half a time. And he opened his mouth and blasphemies against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven. It was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and the authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him. Everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, the captivity he goes. If anyone kills with a sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. It's interesting how that ends. I like to look at, I like to look at many different translations here when we look through this. Here is the perseverance. I like the other one. This requires. I think this is better. Instead of here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints, this NET translation says this requires steadfast endurance and faith from the saints. I think that seems a little cleaner for what we're trying to get here. So in these situations, in this circumstance. Huh. Okay. It's always good to have multiple translations with you to kind of help explain the story. Okay, so here we are. We'll just start in verse 1, like we typically like to do. It seems John, again, uses the help of Daniel to describe his beast, as well as the next one that we'll see coming out of the earth. In Daniel 7:3, where Daniel has the vision of the four great beasts, it does not seem that the seer here is using the sea as any sort of symbol, but if you're looking for theological significance, it could be based on the idea that the sea sometimes is depicted as, you know, stormy political and social situations, out of why tyrannical governments arise. There's been other ideas during the time, especially during this time period, and even well before this, people look at the at the sea as a place of evil. The sea in many mythological stories, as well as just non-mythological stories, and they just kind of thought and believed this, was viewed as a place for evil deities to dwell, pretty much deities that would rule the world. And when you had a storm at sea, was for the most part an expression of the deity showing its wrath, so the wrath of the gods. So it would make sense that the latest great enemy of God would be coming out of the sea because, well, that's where evil would come from and many of their viewpoints. We will learn more about the horns and heads of the beast in chapter 17. We'll talk a little bit today about it, but chapter 17 is where the majority of that will come from. Here we are is where the angel or an angel of a judgment provides an interpretation of the beast and its rider. That's what we will see in chapter 17, where we'll get a interpretation on an angel. I'm not sure who the angel is. I don't recall. Maybe it's one we haven't met yet. We've met many, I know. They start getting confusing after a while. With that, we do know that the ten horns are representative of the kings of kings, much like the ones we again see in Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel, it is the ten kings that represent the four nations of Babylonia, Media, Persia, and Greece. You'll also know other things referenced, those based on the large statue that Nebuchadnezzar had in his dream, representing those four nations. And there are many other symbolic pieces to those four nations throughout the book of Daniel. What we'll see in chapter 17 of Revelation, the seven heads are to be the seven kings. I know we can hardly wait for that, but you will have to because that's a couple weeks away. We do know from here that each head has a horn with a diadem or royal crown shown for authority. Again, these are not crowns of victory like we've seen in the past. These are crowns of authority or perceived authority. And what you'll also notice here is that the crowns are not on the heads. The crowns are on the horns. And the reason that would say is it possibly represents authority based on brute force. It has just forced itself into authority. It was not earned in a good way, but was pushed upon the people, that level of authority. Please do not think too hard about the actual look of the beast. Like I've said before, it's really hard for John to be able to, you know, he's describing it the best way he can. John provides quite a bit of variation in his description, and it would be hard to really even determine how ten horns would look on seven heads. So you can try to draw that out, and the next person next to you is going to draw one out, and the person next to you is going to draw one out, and it's all going to look very different, just because that's how our minds work and imaginations work. This is not prescriptive. He's just providing some description of what he is seeing, and who knows what, you know. Based on the seven heads, some would say that the beast is a mirror image of the dragon, reference to chapter 12, verse 3. Not sure why there are seven beyond the possibly the idea of course, completeness, which is something we know from apocalyptic literature, that seven is used for completeness, also used for perfection. This would make sense, I would think, as the ultimate and powerful enemy of the believing church. So there you have so seven would mean the ultimate here. So you have the ultimate evil, the ultimate enemy against the church. So the idea that anytime you get the number seven or 777, I know there's a lot to that, but seven can also represent, it represented more than just, you know, goodness, or, you know, the sign of God, or whatever that is. But, you know, 666, sign of beast, which is incomplete. So much history, so much baggage. The names of blasphemy point to the ongoing and increasing desire of Roman emperors to be named as deities. There are many of them. For example, Augustus wanted to be known as Divus, or one like the gods. Nero was referred to as a savior of the world whenever he would mint his coins. That's what he would put on them, or have them put on them. The Roman Senate regularly declared deceased emperors as divine. Domitian had his own issues. He would want it to be known as Dominus et Deus Noster, which means our Lord and God. And so these guys were really high on themselves and really wanted to be known as deities, and people would worship them. And of course, if you didn't, you'd get killed, which is a huge issue that John and the church are dealing with and is being brought up here. But as believers, because they're getting martyred, and the faithful ones realized that it was only God they were to worship and serve, and not the mortals. Thus, the title of divinity for mortals was an arrogant blasphemy. As we go through the ongoing description of the beast in the next several verses, we'll see that John is putting together the description of the Roman Empire, who is, at that time, the ultimate persecutor of the church, so the seven-headed dragon. The Roman Empire came onto the land from the sea when invading the eastern Mediterranean, so that could be that depiction of coming the seven-headed dragon coming from the sea. That's Rome coming from the Mediterranean. The Roman Empire, as it grew its imperial power, claimed a religious sanction for what it did to people. Yet we can stop there. It was more than just the Roman Empire. John is pulling what he knows from the current situation, but at the same time, he seems to know the complete fulfillment of the situation awaits the final consummation of human history. So John is dealing in his current historical context with what he knows, but it seems he also knows that there will be this ongoing evil, this ongoing persecution of the church beyond just his time and time until, of course, the end of human history. The beast as we know it will always be an intense manifestation and deification of secular authority, so of governments, of systems, and that's what we see here. It is what we know to be counterfeit and self-centered, believing it to be fully autonomous, expecting total allegiance and praise. And that's what you see from a lot of governments, and not just today, and not in the future, but since the beginning of time, there has been that desire for those in power to believe that they're fully in power, they're autonomous, they're expecting allegiance, they're expecting praise. Not all, of course, systems of power, but many do, and many have, and there's just history just points to that over and over and over again. You could probably list several of those situations going on today, but you could also list several situations that was like this 200 years ago, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 25 years ago. So, as we look into verse 2, the beast continues to be described, and again, looks much like we saw in Daniel 7. Daniel sees the winged lion, a bear with three ribs between his teeth, a four-headed leopard, and a terrible beast with iron teeth and many horns. Those are, of course, depicting the nations that were going to attack and take out Israel. It seems here that John is combining the four and setting them up as the Antichrist. The epitome of bestial opposition to the seed of the woman is what we're seeing here. And so John is kind of putting all that evil together to be able to explain this current evil that they're dealing with and how it's going to continue to harass them. John would combine the powers and the evil of the four nations from Daniel so that he believed that Rome was just as satanic and terrible as those previous four. Think of it as the sum total of all evil of what he is trying to depict here. Some would provide some additional details specific to each animal, where you have the fierce cruelty of the leopard, the slow crushing power of the bear, the dreaded fierceness of a lion. You have all that thrown in here as well. Again, it's less about the description and drawing it perfectly and more about the point John is making, that the beast is terrifying and utters blasphemies against God and persecutes those who are faithful to God. That's ultimately what John is trying to say here. He could really care less what the beast looks like or what you want to draw or try to explain to people. It's more of like, this is evil, it's terrifying, and it's persecuting the people of God. We have to also remember here that the beast only gets his power from Satan. It is only able to rule the way it does because of this authority. If the beast is Rome, which it is, we can see how Rome had an unholy alliance with Satan and was doing the work of Satan to help Satan destroy the church, or the evil one, the adversary, to destroy the church. You may find it odd that John had such a distaste for Rome after reading works from Romans and 1 Timothy and 1 Peter. What we know based on the timing of this book, the relationship with Rome and Christians had deteriorated significantly. The truce they once had was gone, with now the aggressive desire of emperor worship was being forced upon everyone, and if you did not fall in line, you were persecuted. So at one point earlier on, when some of those other letters were written, it wasn't as bad for the Christians. It was actually relatively okay for the Christians, but it has gone to the point now to where it is just pure persecution and oppression of the Christian faith. In this battle between good and evil, the Christians had to obey the authority of God, and for that, they were punished by the beast, or by the Rome, the Romans. Verse 3, one of the beast's seven heads had a wound that seemed like it should have been fatal, but alas, it was not. With that, the world is quite impressed. Some have taken the damaged head as the Roman emperor Caligula, as he was very ill, yet recovered. So he had attempted to set up a statue in the temple, which could be the reference in the upcoming verse 6 that we're about to see. He also erected several other altars around the empire that would encourage a type of universal worship, as we will see even further along in verse 8. Others say that the head could be symbolized of Nero, with a combination of Domitian, as it was Nero who first really persecuted the church, and his policy was revised when Domitian stepped in. The wound itself could be the growth of the apostolic church in the early days. So what caused this pain, or this wound upon this one head of the dragon or the beast, is the apostolic church. So the new church had, you know, had won a battle. I guess you could look at that. Nero, who was able to gain the throne through the treachery of his mother, there's so much to that story that we don't have time to go into, began to really persecute the church in AD 64. He seemed to have faked his death, or maybe he did not, in AD 68. And the idea was that he would do this to get out of a death sentence for being such a horrible person, because even the Romans at one point were like, hey, let's get rid of this guy. It was never really proven if he died or not, but a legend arose at the end of the century that he would rise from the dead and seize power. And so some people say, well, that's what this head of the seventh head of this beast is. I don't know. All of these options could be a bit of a stretch, especially Nero's, as it was never stated that the head was restored. It was the beast who recovered, not the head. We'll see this repeated later on in verse 14. The idea of the seven heads being seven kings really does not take off until chapter 17, so we're not going to go much into it here at this point, but we'll do a few things. It could possibly tie to one other historical event. If Rome were to be the beast, the recovery of the fatal blow would be a relatively peaceful time under the reign of Vespasian, from AD 69 to 79. Then again, possibly nothing historical is intended here, because we don't really know if John was always trying to use historical references or not, but sometimes we can deduce that he was, and sometimes it's just a big stretch. Maybe it just seems or means that the beast is strong and powerful, and though it had been wounded along the way, we don't know how, it has returned with increased power and vengeance and anger because it's upset that it has an injured head. Since the beginning of recorded time, the beast has gone against the people of God, from Pharaoh in Egypt, we refer to that as the beast, to the Roman Empire, the entire time determined to devour all who refuse to pay homage to the beast, which again, we see that time and time and time and time and time again through the Pharaoh, Nebuchadnezzar, Rome, I mean, and many, many in between. It has been beaten up and survived, which is why the world looks on in amazement. They're like, oh, wow, this is impressive. This thing is surviving it, even though it's been pretty well knocked around. So we are, as people, we are made to worship as humans, and we're made to worship things that seem like absolute power. And of course, a beast this powerful seems pretty absolute, and so we would worship it or turn to it at least, or be impressed by it. And we know that people will give their alliance to the beast or to the lamb, a decision at some point we'll all have to make. And so, you know, it's kind of our own decision to make. Are we going to follow the evil, impressive evil things that are going on, or the very good things that are going on? Which is it that you will follow? In verse 5, we have the people of the earth not only worshiping the beast, but the dragon as well. This represents the worship or deification of a secular power, which is like the worship of Satan. This is where things really went sideways. The deification of its emperors was equal to the worship of Satan, based on if Satan, yeah, I mean, this is the tie in between evil and the deification of people. The power of the beast is not about its moral greatness, but more about the awesome power of its might. It wasn't because it was this morally great being, is because it was so powerful and taking things out, and is like, oh, that's impressive, that's cool, I'd like to see that blow up again, that sort of thing. The power and authority is that of Satan's, which in some cases can look really nice. If you look at the temptations that Satan tried to provide to Jesus, that'd have been really cool to a lot of people, to have power over all of the earth and to be able to do things that Satan had tempted Jesus to do. And the question that is being asked, there's a mocking or a parody against similar questions that were asked about God in the Old Testament, such as, if you were to go back to Exodus chapter 15, verse 11. As we continue on here, verse 5, once again, we go back to Daniel 7 and the little horn, also known as Antiochus Epiphanes. If you recall, the little horn was quite a mouthy and boastful little thing, and he would ask who was above him and who could defeat him. He would magnify himself above all other gods. The guy was a complete, I mean, I don't know what word to use, but it was not bad, bad, bad person. Notice here that the beast is the same as the little horn, speaking blasphemies against God, just like our friends back in Daniel 7. Also note that the beast has been allowed or was given. So you got to keep that in mind. The allowance and the given part tells us that the beast is subordinate to something. We and the readers of the time would understand that the authority at this time is coming from God, is allowed to do some of the things it's doing. And kind of like going back to Job, where Job was able, lost all these things and had a horrible experience. God allowed it, ultimately was in control of it, which is hard for some people to digest how this works. But ultimately what we can see from here is that God is ultimately in control and can see well beyond anything that we see, and knows the best path forward. At least we have that faith, or many of us have that faith. Just like I was saying here, like all evil, the operation of the beast is within the limits of God sets. Thus, the beast is upset because he knows of his limit of time and power. Here we know that the limit to be 42 months, which is a traditional period of religious persecution and something we have seen time and time again. So for 42 months, the beast carries out the will of the dragon. You can't say the will of God, because it wasn't the will of God. We know what the will of God is, but the will of the dragon. But given that ability to do so, or allowed to do so. Verse 6. We're humming along. It's like we're that new Ford F-150 Lightning. We're going 0 to 60, 4.5 seconds. It's going to be amazing. Anyways, verse 6. We are seeing the activities of the Antichrist, like we would see from Paul in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4. He will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God. That's a reference to what we're seeing here. Based on how John has referenced Daniel 7, we know he is looking at the Antichrist as those emperors who are now in Rome, who with their secular authority assume the mantle of being gods. This has continued to happen in systems and governments ever since this time. Even before this time. The use of to open the mouth would tell us that these were words and blasphemies that were sustained over a long period of time. It seems that there are three objects of blasphemy in this situation. They're going after the name of God, God's dwelling place, and those who dwell in heaven. So we know that the slander of blasphemy, who's blaspheming God, is to speak evil or against all that God stands for. We get those three points here. The reference to the dwelling place may think point to when Caligula intended to put a statue in the Holy of Holies, aka the manifested glory of God here on earth, the Shekinah glory. Man, I should know that. Thank you, Amy Grant. So that's where that is too. Then again, it is doubtful, as it seems it is not John's attempt here to bring in historical allusions. But anyways, it could have been a reference to Caligula. It could or could not be. But anyways, we know that it's blasphemy against God. So those who dwell in heaven, that reference, that third reference here, could be either angels or the church viewed from its ideal perspective as being seated in heaven. So either the church in its ideal way or in divine beings such as angels. And then you wonder, I guess there's other divine beings besides angels, because there's elders and there's probably others that we have never talked about or would not know of, has not been revealed to us. It's again one of the mysteries of God. Verse 7, As we move forward, we are given a description of the type of authority given to the beast to be able to make war against the saints, as well as to demand universal worship. The first part of this verse goes back to, can you guess it? Yes, Daniel 7. This time, verse 21, just like those who were loyal to Jerusalem and fought for Jerusalem fell in battle against Antiochus, so will believers now fall before the emperor. Universal, but not all authority is given to the beast over all people groups. Though the saints are being put to death, they are in fact the victors, as we will see in a few chapters from now in chapter 15. We are given evidence that the authority was all-powerful based on the usage of was given. Something or someone of higher authority gives the authority. Here, the authority is the dragon seeking revenge on God and the church. We know that even the dragon is under the authority of God. The one with all the authority and all the might is God, and the dragon is even under. So it's like beast, dragon, God. But not that God is evil, which is hard for some people to understand. Not some people. I hate when people say some people. Some people don't understand that. In cases, it seems it's odd that God would allow this to happen. And it is. But at the same time, God is trying to get people to seek him. And sometimes it's a little hard for us to do that. And so we have to have some hard stuff happen for that to happen. And this is, I guess, one way to depict that. So we can look at this here as a testing of faith. So those who had become martyrs who would be willing to give up their lives rather than their hope in God. And that's kind of what we're pushing towards too as we go through this. Verse 8, all the world but those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life will worship the beast. Jesus spoke of this beast or the Antichrist that would come and deceive even those who seem to already be elect or in the Lamb's Book. We get that from Matthew 24:24. Remember, at this point, the Roman state believed it had religious significance and the emperors had become deified. We're seeing the ultimate perversion of secular authority, which again continues to this day, with the desire to be worshipped, or better said, to demand to be worshipped, because look at all the great things we are doing for you. And that could be part of what's happening here, too, is that the beast wasn't just doing like mean, evil things, but it was also kind of doing some really neat things. And people were like, oh, that's impressive. Oh, I think I'm going to go follow this guy and worship this because it's impressive and neat. And so, and it's benefited me in some way, but it's really not that much of a benefit, but it seems like it is. And anyways, that's a lot of logic there. The very thing that Jesus was tempted by in Matthew 4:8-10 is now happening at the consummation of human history, all the power over all the earth. The reference to the creation of the world is brought up 10 times in the New Testament and is a reference to the creation in the visible sense. Jesus speaks of a kingdom prepared since the creation of the world. Paul also brings up believers' election before the creation of the world in Ephesians 1. So this is all going back to what we're seeing there in verse 8. Based on how this is written, was the writing of the believers' names or the death of the Lamb that dates from the creation of the world. It's kind of sometimes a little bit hard to figure out what it is, how this is all written or how the written was written. Well, let's just read it again. Whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. It is believed that the faithful protected are guarded by their election in the Lamb's book of life. They're protected from the misleadings of the Antichrist. I think we can take that from this. To help us with this, we might need to look at the Greek syntax and treat it as the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world, which would tell us that the death of Christ was a redemptive sacrifice decreed in the councils of eternity, because that all makes, that's just crystal clear. With all that said, we must note from chapter 3, verse 5, that one's name could be blotted out of the book of life, telling us we must hold fast in times of trial and deception from evil. So there is that ability and tendency for that to happen if we are not those who remain faithful in God. We get a very famous Jesus quote as we start going into verses 9 and 10, and then we'll wrap up for the day. We have quite a statement that is about to be said, and we of course know this based on the hear this, like those, if anyone has an ear, let him hear. And then this one, I should have just read more out of this one today. If anyone has an ear, he had better listen. That is definitely true, because something very important is about to be said. The seven churches, when those letters were written to the seven churches earlier on, had also something very similar written in their letters. The text here could be a bit confusing, and to our modern ears seems a bit terse about how it is being written. Depending on your translation, you'll be able to see who is taken captive and killed by whom. We see, and if you were to use the New International Version or the NIV in verse 8, that it is those whose name is written in the Book of Life. There's a certain grim reality that lies ahead of the believers, that they will face death, and they will be taken into captivity, and many of those will face death. And so that's a pretty grim reality of the early church there in Rome. And to be honest, is a grim reality in many churches around the world today who deal with very similar sort of issues. Much like Jesus met his death through the hands of an evil secular power, Rome, they will face the same end result today, just like people today face their end through the hands of an evil secular power. Don't need to name anyone or nations or anything, because that's not relevant here, but we can know that that's just kind of natural of how things have happened and how they've played out. The Greek here is very strongly suggests the inevitability of the persecution and the death for those who are faithful. They must loyally endure, is what is being said here. This set of text here sets the tone of this entire apocalypse. They must endure the pain, they will soon faith. They must hold steadfast in their faith in God. They must remain faithful in God. When the inevitable happens to the church, the believers will need to meet it with a steadfast endurance and an unwavering faith. So that's, again, John is trying to communicate that to the people, to give them hope, a hope of a future. John is preparing the people for what is to come. It will be to their advantage to be fully informed of the increased activity of Satan, which John is trying to provide to them. It's something for us to know as well, that we will be continually attacked by evil forces, tempted by evil throughout our lives. And that's something that we work with. And that's why, of course, we have a relationship with God, and we have a relationship with a community of other believers in order to work through this evil, in order to work through our faith, in order to come closer to God, remain faithful in God. There's a view that God will remove people from suffering, but that is not what is being written here. They instead must understand there will be suffering, and with that they must have patient endurance and faithfulness. Again, that's why we pray. That's why we have a community with God. That's why we have a fellowship of saints, of believers who come together to be able to keep each other strong and faithful. That's where we are. Next week, we will begin with the beast from the earth, which is chapter 13, verse 11. We'll run through the rest of chapter 13. We'll go into the lamb and the 144,000 on Mount Zion in chapter 14. And probably do, let's see, what is that? Probably do all of chapter 14 next time. And then we return to heaven in chapter 15, but that won't be next week. So the rest of chapter 13 and all of 14 next week. I hope everyone has a good rest of their day. Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.